Welcome to Real Talk with Oribi, where we tackle real problems with real people and discover real solutions. I'm your host, Munashe Dzikiti, the Communications and Community Management Officer at the Oribi Incubator. And for those who do not know us, Oribi is a nonprofit impact entrepreneurship incubator dedicated to driving social change in South Africa. Today, we're thrilled to have Sandile Chabalala and Tasneem Jatam. Please excuse me if I'm pronouncing it wrong.
Fancy way.
Just to introduce our guests, Mr. Chabalala boasts many years of experience in both the public and private sectors, specializing in corporate governance, corporate philanthropy, human rights, and entrepreneurship. Mr. Chabalala is the recipient of the Mail and Guardian Top 200 Young South Africans 2023 under the business category supported by the African Bank and a recipient of the News 24 100 Young Mandelas of the Future 2023 under the humanitarianism category. In 2023, Mr. Chabalala was appointed as the non-executive director of Scout South Africa, the biggest youth organization in the country, and is also the co-founder of Huruma Bantu. Tasneem is a lifelong learner and experimenter with a plethora of interests in social, environmental, and economic impact. She aims to create a better world while acknowledging the systems it is caught up in and how they are not serving the non-human natural world or humans alike, and hopes to contribute to the pursuit of economic and social ecological justice, as well as enable the agency of people and industries to do the same. She has a history working at various levels of the food systems, from nutrition to academia, and now has the current programs and innovations lead at Oribi. Thank you both for joining us today. You are both truly inspirational individuals who are very knowledgeable in the entrepreneurship sphere and the social entrepreneurship world. And as you might notice, this month, our core focus is really to educate the audience about social entrepreneurship and inspire these social entrepreneurs. And, you know, entrepreneurship alone is a very lonely journey. And I truly believe that it is important that we create more spaces where entrepreneurs can feel understood and inspired. So the focus of today's conversation, however, is centered around the importance of remaining innovative when running a business and exploring the latest trends and successful social enterprises and what makes them so successful. So before we dive into it, I would like to hear more about your background, or your backgrounds. You know, what has led you to, for instance, with Sandile, to become the co-founder of Huruma Bantu and, you know, the programs and innovations lead at Oribi? Maybe we could start with you, Sandile.
Thank you so much, Munash, and thank you so much to Oribi team for inviting me to the podcast today. I'm really feeling honored to be here to share a bit of my story, but also my thinking and some of the work that I do in the impact economy. I think by way of introduction, as you've said, my name is Sandile Chabalala and I'm the co-founder of Huruma Bantu. I think it's important to say that Huruma Bantu means compassion people. So it means compassion in Swahili, Huruma, and then Bantu means people in Siswati. And already those are two very important social words. So they already set the tone in terms of distinguishing us as a social business. So I think it was very important for us to do that. How we started our business, it was me and my best friend, Bali Kumalo, who started the business when we were sitting on Jamie's stairs at the University of Cape Town eating popcorn. And we decided that, you know what, friend, we're never going to work for corporates all our lives. At some point, we need to have our own thing. And that's when we immediately thought, okay, what are we going to do? Let's raise the company and have a bank account. And we did just that, even though we didn't have a client, we didn't have a business plan, what we did, those registrations. And through that, a seed was born. But it took a lot of time until, you know, the seed grew and it showed us that it wants to be a tree. And so for the past 5 years, I've been full time in the business. And so that means, you know, if you think about every month, I have to find ways to look after myself and look after other people that we work with. And so that's quite a lot of work, as you can imagine. But essentially, both of us as best friends were driven by a mutual and a common sensitivity towards the kind of society we live in. And I think Bal and I share a very common heart towards caring for people who could be in need, but also trying to find the heart within corporates. So we know that corporates often don't always have a heart, but they have the money, they have the jobs, they have the offers, they'll give you a laptop, but where is the heart of that corporate? And I think Huruma Banvu is it's a kind of social business or a social enterprise that really wants to partner, collaborate with corporates in order to bring them back to that heart, but also to bring back the heart of the fact that business can be good in society. And so a lot of our projects, which I'll speak about later, are very much within the ecosystem of advocating for the goodness of business in society, but also how impact curation within the entrepreneurship landscape can bring about meaningful societal change.
Wow, that's amazing. For me, I can personally relate to that a lot. I think it's just difficult, especially as a young person, to envision yourself just being like almost like a corporate slave for the rest of your life and getting involved in organizations and companies that genuinely have a heart and are trying to make a difference in society is incredibly fulfilling. And yeah, Tasneem, I'd love to hear more about what's led you to programs lead at REB.
Yeah, sure. Sorry about that. So my first love is food. That's just something that's defined my career path, I think. I started off in healthcare, working in nutrition and working with patients and just thinking, really feeling very frustrated and thinking around, well, these people are coming to, you know, a healthcare setting at the end of when the disease has reached a point where it's actually at a dire state. And that's because of like a much larger systemic issue of the food system itself, not serving people. And then I slowly also learned that the food system is also not serving the planet either. So just not doing what it's supposed to be doing generally. Right. And that's what got me into academia and researching around the food system and how do we transition into something new and something more innovative. And so I did my master's in sustainable development with a focus also on food, the food system transformation. But I worked a lot with food system entrepreneurs who were trying to change the system itself through entrepreneurship, and that's what really planted a seed for me in that, hey, this is something that can really, like, entrepreneurship or social entrepreneurship can really change industries. And so that is kind of where I, you know, started on this journey, and I also had some businesses of my own, mostly in the food space. And then after that, I had learned about Oribi and kind of was always aware of Oribi doing amazing things in society, and then have now, you know, just manifested this dream job, which is at, you know, as programs and innovation lead at Oribi, where I get to work in the space of innovation and with food social entrepreneurs every day.
Right. Amazing. I mean, I can definitely attest to the amazing work that REB is doing in the food system space. And from a personal level, and just like as an average person, my knowledge when it came to just food systems was basically from a consumerism perspective, you just taking in and not really considering the systems that go into, you know, the food systems and the food ecosystem. So I think I've learned quite a lot from both you and our food systems team. There's so much to learn in this sphere. And just to move on and to fill you guys in on the conversations we had last year, we were breaking down the meaning of social entrepreneurship. So this was with Sune and Nolita, who is our Girls in Business lead, as well as a Girls in Business alumna, who's Miami. And we asked Sune, or I asked Sune, to define social entrepreneurship for us. And she defined it so well, saying that a social entrepreneur is someone that drives a business that is not only profit-driven, but it is also a purpose-driven business and is usually hooked to a cause, for instance, poverty, unemployment, and youth development. And we also spoke briefly about some misconceptions that people have when it comes to social entrepreneurship. For instance, a lot of social enterprises are seen as charity cases, and they're seen from an NGO lens, which is far from the truth. You know, they're essentially businesses with a moral compass, right? And social entrepreneurs are using business to do good. Sandile, I would like to hear from you, you know, about some of the latest trends that you've come across in social entrepreneurship, and how are these trends influencing the way social entrepreneurs operate and scale?
Thank you so much. I think that's a really great question, because I think it's very important to always have to define the bigger terms. And I think social entrepreneurship has a lot of misconceptions and, like you said, sometimes misunderstanding. But I think there are two very important words that are very distinct within the two. I think, first of all, you know, the word social. What is social? Mm-hmm. Social is the day-to-day reality that we see within how people, nature, and how we basically exist within the world of economics, how that all of that is interrelated and intersectional. But entrepreneurship is a particular response to that, through an individual means of a particular mindset that wants to change that particular condition or wants to make a difference in how that social landscape could look like. So we very much do rely on entrepreneurs to actually change the social dynamics in our society. And this isn't just unique in Africa or unique in South Africa, or it's unique across the world. You know, entrepreneurs are people that have the ability and the tendency to actually shift how social conditions are arranged. And this could vary from e-commerce, it could vary from technology, it could be vary from food, it could vary from all sort of entrepreneurial ideas which are fundamentally meant to make the social cohabiting easier, better, and often sustainably. And so that's really what you would be behind a mindset of a social entrepreneur. But to come back to your question, which is quite interesting around the trends, I think one of the very pressing things for me, where I find myself, you know, in now, is understanding the impact of climate change in our in our society, and seeing how weather conditions are really changing to be radical, but also changing to affect us and find us not ready to actually cope with the effects of severe weather conditions, but also how long rain can last and all those kinds of severe consequences. And that obviously then has a huge question around what happens to food when it has flooded, what happens to resilience for people who are living or have households in places where, you know, they get washed away, and what happens to the rebuilding of all of that. Right. And I think for me, it really has caught a lot of curiosity within the social, ecological resilience, you know, kind of like landscape of how to look at intersectionality of how social conditions and how ecological conditions are interrelated. And I think from that, I've recently, you know, really had a conversation with Balesa from AgriCool, and I also had a conversation with Francois from Lumkani, both founders of those businesses. And what AgriCool does, obviously, they very much big on the agricultural ecosystem within Pietermaritzburg. But what I've also done is to identify seasonality. So in other words, when you grow cabbage in one particular part of Pietermaritzburg, you have to also grow in another part, so that if anything happens to that particular land, you can rely on the harvest on the other side. And that's basically take advantage of seasonality to ensure that the impact of severe weather or climate doesn't necessarily put you at a huge risk. So de-risking has become part of their model in their business, part of educating people about how to plant and harvest, you know, within a much more sustainable way, has been integral to their business. So that's a very good example of how some of the trends are shifting, where social entrepreneurs aren't just solving, you know, global clothing, retail, food, or transport issues, but it's also the ecological space, the nature space, where people are finding new ways to safeguard communities and people from that. So I think for me, some of the trends are really the innovation that's shifting in that space. I think I'll leave it for now.
No, that's amazing. I mean, there's always this thing that probably from consuming a lot of media content, that I've always seen about how, you know, people always drive this point that it's not government that necessarily leads the world. This could be untrue. Please feel free to correct me. Yeah. But it's essentially businesses, you know, and their efforts that determine, you know, where the world is being driven to. And I think that it's very important that, you know, we broaden on this conversation and build on the topic of social entrepreneurship and helping our audience understand what is social entrepreneurship, just to, you know, get an understanding of its impact and to break down some of the myths that, you know, and misconceptions that have been built around this topic. Absolutely. And Tasneem, I would like to hear your thoughts on this as well. You've been working on the ground alongside entrepreneurs who are a part of the AfriFoodlinks program. Are there any trends that you are noticing from our local entrepreneurs? And maybe just touch a bit on what the AfriFoodlinks program is.
Yeah, sure. So the AfriFoodlinks program is an incubation program run by Oribi in partnership with a much broader research project called AfriFoodlinks, and its aim at the broader level is to transform urban food environments and urban food systems. So thinking a lot about where there's a lot of unsustainability in the food system at various levels, but this one is focused more specifically on like city spaces and how food travels through there. And so that is what the broader program is about. And then we are the incubation partners. So we are supporting at the moment roughly around 50 entrepreneurs within the early stages of their food businesses and how they think about transforming these urban food spaces. And that's also a big focus on circularity. So. Meaning how do we close the loop on resource use? How do we produce less waste? And that is a trend more broadly in the social entrepreneurship field. Mm. So how do we reduce or rethink or repurpose waste? And for us specifically, that's within the food system. So people are, you know, kind of in our entrepreneurial ecosystem thinking about how do you repurpose food that's not yet gone bad but is stale or not sellable, right. And how do you produce something new from that, or how do you produce new forms of compost? And this also speaks to what you guys were talking about earlier around if government or, you know, if society is not serving a purpose, or it's not, for instance, if there's a big waste problem and nobody's cleaning that up, entrepreneurship, social entrepreneurship, can go there and actually help that system you know, regulate itself. And so then we're seeing a lot of waste entrepreneurs, and also in our program, food waste entrepreneurs as well.
Right.
So that's one trend I can think of. But then also at the other levels, we have, you know, agri-tech more generally, but in our programs, people supporting agriculture, people supporting farmers with new knowledge systems, how to do regenerative farming. So that's on the farming side, and then we also think about on the food side, new ways of producing food, ways of producing food more sustainably, changing what we eat, maybe to think about more nutritious food as well. And these are some of the trends we're seeing. And then also in the rethinking space, people are even rethinking how do we even, what kind of foods are we thinking about growing? How do we think about changing our diets to more local, indigenous, climate resilient foods, and that takes a lot also from indigenous and historical wisdom, where on this continent and in this country, prior to certain grains being consumed, there were much more nutritious grains being consumed and produced on this continent that are indigenous and local to this space and working with our weather conditions. And how do we think about that when we bring in, how do we use maybe the past or history to actually think about how we innovate in the future. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, maybe a combination of future technology linking with past wisdom is a trend also that we're seeing a lot.
Right. Wow, amazing. Incredible. I mean, I want to dive a little deeper around the conversation of tech a little bit later. I think for me, a concern is around, you know, accessing resources for these entrepreneurs to make use or to go forward with agri-tech or tech-related businesses that are making a social impact. But we'll touch on that a little bit later. I just want to follow up on that and ask also, you know, what do you see as the biggest challenge being faced by these social entrepreneurs today?
Okay, so it's not just maybe one challenge, but I can see some trends in challenges, one of them being that it's hard to kind of find your space, find your product market fit, like where are you sitting in the value chain, and that's kind of what we are doing at Oribi, is trying to support and enable entrepreneurs in finding that fit, like where do they fit in, what is their solution exactly. And then we also have the balancing act that social entrepreneurs need to play, or impact entrepreneurs need to play, in that they are making impact and they are dealing with problems in their community or ecological challenges, but how do you balance that with actually making profit and being self-sustaining? So that's definitely a big one in social entrepreneurship, to not, you know, be perceived as a charity or simply a social cause, but also be taken seriously as a business in its own right, and that your primary your dual purpose is to make money and in addition to making impact. I think that is a challenge from perception. People are, you know, society is still unsure of where social entrepreneurs fit into that space. And then I would add one more, which is accessing financing. So understanding what is the financing landscape, me as an entrepreneur, how can I navigate that, how can I apply, who can I apply to, who is providing funding for the type of entrepreneur or the type of business that I am. That it's a tricky landscape to navigate. And so we hope also in our programs to make that easier for entrepreneurs to understand. But also just generally bootstrapping your business is very, very difficult in this economic climate. Right. So just accessing money to scale or to even start, like, you know, entrepreneurs, you know, you would need to at some point have room to fail or room to explore what your idea is.
Yeah.
And that's very difficult if you have a full-time job, or if you don't have a job and you this is just your main hustle and you don't have the funds to carry on.
Right. No, I completely agree. And what level of entrepreneur, or what business levels are these entrepreneurs you're usually working with? Is it startup? Have they already launched? Where exactly are they on this journey?
So for the AfriFood Links program more specifically, we are working with very early stage entrepreneurs, some who are still in the ideation phase, so still figuring out what is their idea.
Right.
What are they trying to sell? What service or product are they trying to do? Very much in the exploratory phase, which is very exciting.
Yeah.
Because people have such amazing ideas.
Right. Yeah. And I see that you have these work together sessions where, you know, they can all like chip in and help each other grow and explore these ideas better. So I think that's wonderful. Sandile, I want to move to you. Just going back to last week, we asked one of our young social entrepreneur from the Girls in Business program what challenges or problems she has faced in the entrepreneurship world. And she answered this question with positivity and a lot of motivation, which was incredible. Like, given the economic standing of South Africa at the moment, you know, I think that there are a lot of challenges being thrown at our youth. And as Tisney mentioned, it's just very difficult to access resources in this economy. And, you know, I think it's amazing to be resilient despite, you know, having the weight on your shoulders, the weight of the world on your shoulders, and to remain positive regardless of that. I would like for us to add to that positivity and share with these young entrepreneurs some exciting opportunities that are accessible, and resources that are accessible to them, you know, to help them make their journey a little bit easier, whether it's through funding or mentorship and etc.
Thank you so much. I think that the definitely it's very admirable every time a young person in Africa, you know, the whole continent, you know, if they decide to start a business, or if they decide to sell a product, or if they decide to invent something, I think it's absolutely admirable, because I think this continent doesn't have a strong legacy of having a history or a past that always propelled us to create. Rather, we've been very much kind of like conditioned to consume.
Right.
So every time a young person, you know, takes the initiative to start something or to create something, I think there's a huge celebration that isn't only felt by their potential customers, but I'm sure there's a celebration of their ancestors as well.
Mm.
And I think I say this because I understand why a lot of young people would say positivity and motivation is a key ingredients to really being resilient and thriving.
Mm.
And I think because I said earlier on that entrepreneurship is about the mindset. So I think there's a big psychological shift that happens when you decide to be entrepreneurship. Often you didn't grow up in a family of entrepreneurs. Often you didn't grow up within a community where entrepreneurs were thriving. But here you are with this idea that you really want to give life to. And I think what technology has done is to make it accessible to hear stories of other people and how they've done it.
Right.
So I think the more we can tap into, you know, the easy spaces such as TikTok, such as following deliberate pages on Instagram, but also reading on what people are tweeting about business or entrepreneurship, is of incredible free access to building confidence in what you do. And I think, you know, every day entrepreneur has to wake up and think, do I want to apply for a job today or not?
Yeah.
You know, because it's tempting to, you know, because you're not break even, you know, making profit, or people are not buying or paying you on time. So there's always that insecurity that comes with being an entrepreneur. And I think the biggest thing is obviously to be celebrated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to be celebrated isn't just the entrepreneur having to work hard to celebrate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think if all of us as individuals know someone is an entrepreneur, we need to often check on them.
Mm.
We need to often support them, and not for supporting by buying, but it's a support of saying, have you eaten? Have you been out? Have you exercised? How's your mindset? How's your psychology? How are you doing?
Right.
Just checking on those individuals is very, very important, because often it can be a lonely journey. And I think a lot of people are not dealing well with the fact that entrepreneurship can be lonely.
Mm.
Another thing that's also quite important is to say that, you know, entrepreneurship exists within a community, and that's why you've got organizations like Oribi that try to bring together a community of certain kinds of entrepreneurs that do certain things, right? And then give them some sort of support or some sort of, you know, incubation or acceleration. Mm. But I always think about an entrepreneur who's a mom sitting on the road of a highway selling vegetables.
Mm.
I think about an entrepreneur who's driving a taxi driver, you know, working maybe on a long distance from Umlazi coming to Johannesburg every day and back and forth. I think about an entrepreneur as of someone who's a domestic worker and they provide services to more than one household. So the variation of entrepreneurship, we also need to respect how simplified it is.
Right.
An entrepreneur isn't someone that we can see in a laptop or having a P2I LTD or having a bank account.
Mm.
I think there's immense work we need to do around celebrating and recognizing informal economy and people that are really participating in informal industries, in particular who are operating in township economies, where, in other words, you know, I always tell people, or every time when I read about it, I like to share it, that townships were never created to be economical spaces.
Mm.
They were just created to be labor, like where labor lives.
True.
And the only, by living, I mean, they just meant to get there and sleep and raise their families in whatever way. But there was no economic activity that was expected that townships would create for itself. So over the years, we've seen townships attracting billions of rands within that particular geographies that were never created to be that. Mm. So what does it say about the resilience of people in those townships? It says to them that they can make their communities places of economic activity. Mm. And I think the economic activity is also not the day-to-day spaza shop taxi drivers. It's also the lady that at the backyard is planting spinach and selling in their street. Yeah. It's also the person who started, you know, who's found a plot of land and decided to do a lettuce vegetable, and now they're supplying to a restaurant and so on. Mm. So the ecosystems of creation and entrepreneurship are so wide, and I think that the motivation and the positivity can live for as long as we decide to recognize those people that are involved there and offer to celebrate them, but to give them the support that they need. And I think often, you know, big corporates or high net worth individuals or impact organizations need to understand and need to profile organizations like Oribi who really have committed to catalyzing those kinds of entrepreneurs in those communities to make them sustainable and to make them fit within a larger economy.
Mm, amazing. You touched on so many important points. For me, some of the key things that you touched on were entrepreneurship, mental health, as well as supporting particularly also township communities. And, you know, from what we've observed as well is that there's usually an extra level of care and support that these entrepreneurs from township areas require, you know, in order to access opportunities that are provided, you know. Correct. So it's one thing to provide the opportunity, but it's also another thing to, you know, giving them a pathway to go and grab those opportunities. So I think there's a big conversation regarding equity and equality.
Correct.
Yeah. Here. So yeah, thank you so much for that amazing point. Tasneem, do you want to touch on a bit on that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, when you were talking, my brain was just lighting up because it's all the things we talk about at Oribi as well, in the sense that in our programs and in the AfriBuildings program specifically, we work mostly with entrepreneurs from marginalized, underserved areas of Cape Town, so the township areas and surrounds. And what we are noticing and learning is that they do have very unique issues and needs that perhaps another incubator might not pick up if they're not working with this demographic of people. And so just, yeah, everything you said around, like, even somebody selling, the mom selling spinach from that she grew in her backyard, like, these are a lot of the kinds of entrepreneurs we work with. And then supporting them in finding their market fit or their problem and solution fit will then become very important in an incubator like ours, but yeah, the challenges are very unique in South Africa, and in Africa within this informal entrepreneurial space. But it's a deeply important part of society because actually on the African continent, the informal food economy is what's feeding the continent.
Correct.
That is where
correct
we are doing a lot of the impactful entrepreneurship. Yes. So why not enable that further instead of keeping that whole industry underserved when it's actually doing so much for society?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think just to add also, I think you may be wondering what kind of examples really speak to this kinds of intervention. I think Oribi is obviously one of the four leading, you know, incubators and really providing access to markets and providing really inclusive development of those entrepreneurs within rural and township, you know, spaces and economy. But I think we also did a project for Huruma Bantu, the business that I've co-founded. We did a project with the Aspen Network of Development Entrepreneurs through the support of Walmart Foundation, where what we did was to basically go to three townships across the country, which was Khayelitsha in the Western Cape, Datsan in the Eastern Cape, and Alexandra in Gauteng. And what we were meant to do was to convene learning labs where we brought entrepreneurs in a room, and we were supposed to facilitate this work around how they understood the barriers into growing or scaling their businesses, but also the barriers into making their businesses thrive within the immediate communities that they work with. And I think what I took out of that entire process, and I think, and in fact, just to go back to what I said earlier on, the report at the end that we produced for Walmart was titled Thriving in Informality, just to really show that these businesses don't often need to be formalized to be successful. They do thrive in their informality because they do get income, they've got clients, and they've got a strategy that they're actually rolling out, and that's why they've been there for a while. And I think a very good example of thriving in informality is I always think when I was young, and I used to go visit my grandmother in the township, it was a very famous shop as we entered the street of my grandmother's house, and it was called Makakula Supermarket, like Bab Makakula Supermarket. And Bab Makakula was a particular man who had this supermarket that was always there. You know, for me, just growing up, there was always Bab Makakula Supermarket. Every time I needed something, I could always go there. And there was a typical township in Japan here who was catering for their community, saw a need, and in fact, they were so innovative that they also could find the right products that people were looking for to buy. But going back to the project that we did, I think one of the most significant thing that we gathered from speaking to the entrepreneurs across the country in South Africa was that a lot of them said they're feeling overtrained. But there isn't enough capital coming in to actually help them grow these businesses. In other words, you can train us and empower us, even show us how to use Excel sheets, make us create websites and all of these things, but at what point do we get given money? And I think that's quite a fundamental question around, at what point do we see capital actually flowing into entrepreneurs that are driving significant social change in our country?
Wow. And just to touch on that point, I mean, there was a day when we hosted our Cape Town's Changemakers Social, and some of the entrepreneurs said, when we are given the money, there's also a lot of restrictions around what we can do with that money and how we operate our businesses. What's being done to solve this? You know, because I do think and believe that there is sort of like an information overload. I mean, perhaps Tasneem, you have more insight around that, given that you know you're running the incubation program. What's being done to ensure that it's not just an information overload and that there are actual resources being given to these entrepreneurs to go off and start their business?
So we try to, in our programs, we try to meet people where they are, meet entrepreneurs where they are, so not getting them to a level where, you know, they're getting spewed all of these very academic or very highfalutin terms at them without understanding their own context. So that is something that we do. We help train our entrepreneurs at the levels that they are in, using the technologies that they are working with already, like WhatsApp, for instance. And then just to bring a little bit of another program into this mix is that, so Oribi is also very curious about this idea of where can funding go that is meaningful to an entrepreneur. So we are working on another program currently, thinking around this issue and providing unrestricted grants to certain entrepreneurial women. And what we want to understand from that is, And when I say unrestricted, it's the opposite of what you were saying, where, you know, it's not restricted at all. They can do whatever they need with that money. And what you find, and because we take a very gender-focused lens at Oribi, you find that maybe providing a woman entrepreneur with unrestricted grant funding, she might spend it on something that you may not see as directly linked to entrepreneurship, but actually is laying a foundation or providing, say, childcare or something like something else that's maybe providing her the opportunity to focus on her entrepreneurship or to think through her idea, you know, giving room to fail. So that is, you know, something that's burgeoning in Oribi that we're trying to understand. Also in our AfriFoodLinks program, we are providing grants as well, and wanting to understand where that money goes. So I think what the industry at large, who is providing these grants, needs to shift towards is more of an trying to understand how that money can enable a person and where it's best spent, as opposed to dictating where can you spend this money. Because like we, you know, we've said earlier, entrepreneurship, township entrepreneurship needs are so unique, and we need to understand that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And Sandile, to go back to your point now about, you know, these entrepreneurs being overtaught, you know, what can we do to combat that? How can we make them feel a bit more secure? What can incubators like REB do differently to ensure that we are not overwhelming them?
I think I do like what Tasmin said around, you know, meet the entrepreneur where they are. I think it's the beginning of a very big, you know, a big part of intervention is really, you know, observing and learning the context in which a particular person you work with is in. And I think a big part of understanding that context is obviously the story. I think a lot of the time we're very easy to bombard people's solution before we've even heard what's their story. You know, what made them do what they do, how far have they gone to get where they are, and along the way, what have they learned and what have they unlearned to get where they are. So I think the story element of entrepreneurship is an incredible missing link in most of what's happening across, around. I think there's a lot of, in many ways, I can't find the right way to describe this, but I do feel an intrusion into people's lives, an intrusion into people's communities in the name of entrepreneurship and in the name of incubation, or in the name of support, or in the name of acceleration, or even trying to help you scale. I think we're forgetting that there's a deeper sense of loyalty that people have to their communities and their products, but also a deeper loyalty to the nuisance of why people create what they create. And I think sometimes we are very quick to take away the African idea or the Africanism of what entrepreneurship is for an African individual. And it is different, right? You know, you can't really impose a Eurocentric or a South American way of entrepreneurship into an African way.
Right.
Yes, you can work together, but there has to be that deep nuisance in which each identifies within its own context. And I think a lot of the time we need to respect that products that are made here and products that are created here, even though, yes, they can scale globally, and a lot of them have, there is an African story to them. And that African story isn't always the story of trauma, brokenness. Sometimes it is a story of generational businesses that have been refined through each generation. I'm sure, you know, all of us know a business that has grown over generations in South Africa. But also, you know, I'd also like just to touch on the notion of indigenous knowledges and practices, to say that, you know, there's a lot of entrepreneurial ideas that often come from indigenous knowledge. In other words, I got this idea to do this product because my grandmother taught me, or because I saw my grandmother do it like this. This could be formulations of shea butter. This could be a particular way of making a certain stew and selling it into the community. This could also could be a way of knitting clothing or using fabrics. So there's many ways that indigenous knowledge also plays a role in giving the identity of Africa itself. And I think that we mustn't be too quick to westernize people and be too quick to put people into innovations that they're not ready for. Rather, how do we scale this fabric where you are and make people connect to it and make people feel the culture and feel the sense of peace that this fabric may carry as a new entry in that particular market. And I think also, as well as the to mention the rural and urban divide, also plays a very dangerous entry where we try to impose urban solutions to rural people that are doing what they're doing within their own communities, and really saying them that you need to operate here in Ulundi like you would be operating in Sandton, or you must be operating, you know, the way you're operating in Dujwa, you must operate like you'll be operating in Kloof Street in Cape Town. It just cannot work like that. We need to identify entrepreneurs where they are and be able to give them the dignity of their own context and their own community, but also celebrate the locality. Celebrate local products. If this product hasn't been out of Eastern Cape and only people in Eastern Cape buy it, perhaps that's all the entrepreneur wanted. And how do you give them that space to say, this is my definition of success.
Right. Mm-hmm. Wow. That's so powerful. And like from a Cape Town context, we have a lot of conversations around the rapid gentrification of Cape Town in general. And I think that, a lot of it is really imposed and pushed onto township entrepreneurs, and it also makes it difficult maybe for the entrepreneur that doesn't necessarily want to stay in the township ecosystem but rather wants to access the Cape Town market. It makes it difficult for them to access that market. It's too expensive, there's just too much going on in terms of access to resources and accessing that market as well. So I think there's just so many ways that we can talk about this. And
there's a lot of barriers. I mean, including language as well is a huge barrier for people. Definitely. But also transportation. If someone is to come from, let's say they come from Guguletu and they need to come sell in the tax rank in town, it's a big barrier around transport fees.
Right.
As well as also, I mean, right now something we have to talk about within this social entrepreneurship context is that, for example, in the Western Cape, there's less and less people actually becoming entrepreneurs because of how unsafe it is to do business where they are.
Wow.
Like the extortion fees and the fact that they have to pay protection fees to do business. And if they compete to somebody else, there's violence that erupts because of that. These are some of the things that also we need to understand, that there's also, like, not everyone can thrive. There are people that actually are denied the opportunity to thrive, and even the opportunity to even know about Oribi as an example, because they just lose the hope completely because they just don't feel safe in their own products or feel safe in the communities where they are to actually start their businesses.
Right. No, absolutely. And maybe to move to a positive note, and you know, you mentioned storytelling and you know, sharing the stories of these entrepreneurs. Tasneem, I wanted us to maybe talk about, you know, the success stories of some of the AfriFoodlinks incubatees and you know, the success stories that showcase an innovative approach to solving food-related issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we are very early on in the program, but what we're noticing is that, well, first of all, what people are gaining from this experience already is the networking opportunities. I think, you know, many minds are greater than just one mind working alone, and there's already a lot of like cross-pollination between ideas and people, and just for people to be able to stress test their idea or bounce it, you know, on somebody else, and that's been a huge success from the program, and it's also what entrepreneurs need more generally. And so that's one. And then I would say also just the content, the learning content that we're putting out. We have, you know, a lot of survey, a lot of feedback saying that this has been very useful for the entrepreneurs in understanding more broadly where they fit into the system as a whole. Like, many entrepreneurs don't realize that they are solving a problem that's part of a much greater system, and that they actually really fit very well into that system, very nicely, and very well positioned to transform it. And then something that is also coming out is that entrepreneurs are realizing their unique selling points and that their stories matter. And that's bringing their own authenticity to their business is actually so important, and we mustn't hide away from that. I think lots of the times entrepreneurs think that they are separate from their business,
right,
or their passion and their business are separate from each other, when actually what are the most inviting stories of entrepreneurship are those that when people put their whole heart and soul and history and context into the story of their business, and like not removing it from one another. And something that Sandile said earlier is also resonated with me a lot, in the sense that, you know, we were talking about how meeting entrepreneurs where they are. Many of these stories linked to indigeneity and indigenous knowledge, local knowledge, they maybe bring about this, a more uniquely African understanding of what innovation is. Because innovation is not always this this new tech on the block. Mm. It's not always incorporating AI into your business model.
Mm.
It's thinking about what do people need and how can I bring it to them in a way that they actually will use. So I'm thinking a lot about spaza shops, for instance, and how you can get at a spaza shop, you can get products in quantities that you need instead of huge quantities.
Mm.
So, you know, a local seller, you can get one apple or you can get one egg if that's all you need, you know, for the day. And there's also unique financial models in that where you can, you know, you can pay at the end of the month or you can pay in installments. And often those kind of things are not possible, those kinds of models are not possible in the more formalized structure.
Right.
And that's really, really innovative. Mm-hmm. Even if we think about Stockfels, those are indigenous and innovative ways of utilizing money or sharing, like in a sharing economy kind of thing. And that's being studied now as an innovation.
Right.
We have an entrepreneur working with us on the AfriFoodLinks program. She is working with local people who brew local beers. So that is, she's bringing it into a new age, or she's, you know, supporting it in new ways. But ultimately, what she's doing is working with local and indigenous knowledge systems to support entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a true definition of innovation.
Right.
I think you really need to look at what is happening on the ground to understand that innovation is all around us.
Mm.
It's not just this new shiny thing that some, you know, leading entrepreneurs are talking about.
Mm.
It's in all spaces and it should be enabled in all ways.
Absolutely. And to touch on the point of, you know, for instance, with the entrepreneurs who get innovative about payment systems and when their customers can pay them back, do you think perhaps there is, maybe I'm looking at this from my own observations. Like I think there's a level of empathizing with the community that, you know, these entrepreneurs have seen, and it adds to their innovation as well, and it shows that, you know, they're really observing and seeing what's going on in their communities, and they're trying their best to make a difference and to have an empathetic lens with how they deal with their customers.
Exactly, know your customer.
Right.
Know your customer, and then also the social part of social entrepreneurship is very important.
Mm.
You do need to understand what kind of conditions your customer is working in and how you can meet them where they are.
Absolutely. And Sandile, I wanted to ask, like, on the topic of innovation, how important or necessary is it for an entrepreneur to remain innovative in their business solutions? And if it is important, why?
I think what's important is that business exists within the spectrum of competition. So you're not the only one who's probably selling what you're selling, or you're not the only one providing the service that you're providing.
Yeah.
But also you're not be the only one, you know, with that kind of commodity that you might be trading. You know, if let's say you're trading vegetables against fruits, or let's say maybe you are trading clothes instead of trading alcohol, right? That you need to understand that it's in a competitive environment of business. And therefore, the big question for most entrepreneurs is what sets you apart. You know, what makes you stand out and what makes you become the preferred person that we go and buy from.
Mm.
And I think a big part of that is the element of visibility matters.
Mm.
So how visible are you? What have you invested in the branding? What's the name of your business? Who is around you? What's your messaging?
Mm.
How does the social media feel like? What are people saying about you as well as a business?
Right.
But another important part as well is trust. I think we undermine the fact that businesses actually get trusted. There's an element of trust that we give into business. There's a reason why people always buy coleslaw mix from Woolworths instead of Spar. You know, there's a reason why people always thrift instead of go to Zara when there's a sale, right? So it's about trust. People trust that particular business or trust that particular service. And that's why it's important for entrepreneurs to always think about how am I changing and how am I refining my goods, or how am I really giving more meaning to my services so that my customers are constantly experiencing a better version of what I deliver. I think that's always a good question. So, you know, a good innovative entrepreneur every day when they wake up, how do I do this differently? How do I do this better? Who do I talk to today and possibly use a different language, or possibly use a different narrative, or possibly use a different story about how I tell my products? And I think, again, that's where storytelling is important, because storytelling is really often a journey. It's about how you trace your journey. No entrepreneur has scaled and suddenly made 5 million overnight or made 10 million in 2 weeks. It was always a journey of either perhaps saving or perhaps reinvesting in the business, right, or perhaps collaborating even. So these are all, you know, innovations. Innovations are also very much respecting the ecosystem in which you work in. Understand who can you actually work with, but also understand who you can't work with, and have good reasons why you can't work with who you can't work with. But I'm very much in our business model, Huruma Banvu, we are very collaborative, but also we work very, very meaningfully within partnerships, because we understand and believe that to actually survive the impact economy, you just cannot do anything alone.
Yeah.
You have to have a spirit and a way of bringing people in. So if we have a project, we bring in people. If a client said to us, okay, here's some funds, do this project, we don't just take the funds and go do it. We understand, okay, if we had to bring Oribi maybe to come talk about this, or if we had to bring Ikamva to come do this, or maybe we had to go bring Youth Capital to come, you know, do this. End of the day, what that all does, it shows people that we are all working together towards innovating each other.
Right.
Because innovation also isn't a singular process. It involves conversations, it involves research, it involves listening, it involves observing how other people do it in order for you to find that niche refinement that you need for your own products. So that's my understanding, or at least my contribution to it.
Right. No, I absolutely agree. And, you know, to add on to innovation, there's also the conversation of sustainability. And I'd like to hear your input on the sustainability of social enterprises. You know, it's one thing to start a business, but it's another thing to maintain and keep the doors of that business open. How can a social enterprise ensure that their initiatives are sustainable and have long-term impact?
I think the first part is to answer that question immediately when you start. Not to answer that question when you've maybe gained your first project or you've done your first client delivery. Is to actually ask yourself that question when you start the business. How am I going to be sustainable? Because the answer to that will lead you to identifying the right partners and the right support that you will need in order to be sustainable. And also let's try to simplify sustainability. I think it's a term that's used to actually confuse people,
right,
but also sometimes to scare people from business.
Right.
Sustainability in business is survival. It's really how your business survives. And how your business survives is it's really how you believe in your own business. That's the first beginning of sustainability. If you as an entrepreneur believe in your own business, you've already mastered the first steps towards sustainability. The second step is then identifying the kind of ecosystem that you can rely on in order to maintain the belief of your own business.
Right.
So in other words, the day that you may not have certain resources to produce, or you may not have certain resources to actually keep going, who do you talk to? And who's actually there for you? That's the second part of understanding who in the ecosystem would be there with you to actually stay sustainable. The third part is the motivation and the positivity and the mindset, but also the huge psychological work you have to do as an entrepreneur is immense in terms of contributing to sustainability. And I think a lot of the time I've found that not enough entrepreneurs read. and not enough entrepreneurs research about their own businesses. I think it's very important to understand what you do and understand what other people have done and how they failed and why they failed, but also what did they do to stand up, right? So that's also a big part of sustainability, is when you enrich yourself with knowledge around what has worked for others and what could work for me. And most of the time that helps you to also have a risk profile of things that are very most likely to happen to make your business succeed. Right. So risk for me, risk management isn't only left for Johannesburg stock listed companies or for big corporates that have millions of rands of turnover. But a risk profile for every entrepreneur is important. Write the 5 things that could lead your business to failing. Mm. And every day, make sure that you understand those things and you are investing towards making sure those things don't happen. And a very big part of it could be financial sustainability.
Right.
It could be human sustainability. It could be operational sustainability. It could be impact sustainability, where your business no longer has relevance to the kind of audience that you want to work for. So sustainability is a very simplified, can be very segmented, but in many ways, it's very much a risk exercise. It's really understanding the kinds of risks that are most likely to affect your business, understanding them, investing in them to mitigate. But also a big part of sustainability is also understanding that you don't operate in a silo. Mm. You operate with other entrepreneurs that you could be working with. And that's why I keep on saying collaborative effort is like the gold of being an African business. Mm. And I think for me, you know, as someone who studied African philanthropy, I really do understand this from a cultural indigenous knowledge of how businesses in Africa have been nothing but a collaborative effort.
Mm.
You know, it's about collaborating to deliver sustainability, not for you at a profit level, but sustainability for food security for the community, for clothing dignity for the community, for supply of water and electricity, or for housing, you know, because entrepreneurship is also, let's keep in mind that the platter is huge for how people can do entrepreneurship. And so with that huge platter, how does it all result to sustainably creating communities that have dignity and can actually enjoy life?
Right.
You know.
Wow. And I think the nature of collaboration is truly an African-inspired notion.
Yes.
Our last session with Sune, you know, they mentioned how with Girls in Business, they teach a lot about Ubuntu. I am because you are. Mm. And I quoted this African proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. And I think you can learn a lot about sustainability from the African culture and African values. So thank you for that. Tasneem, I also just want to hear from you in terms of sustainability. What has REB been teaching social entrepreneurs and their social enterprises about creating a business that is sustainable and long-term?
Mm-hmm. So because we are an incubator, we do touch on the various parts of the business model and how you can incorporate these ideas into your business. And then we do take these ideas a little bit of a step further in trying to build authenticity, help enabling an entrepreneur to build authenticity into their business. Because if you want to if you want this business to be sustainable, you need to really believe in it. You need to really like feel the values of this business, because you're gonna go through really tough times. You're gonna go through many highs and many lows with this idea and with this concept. And so it needs to go the distance, and you need to be able to see that through. I think that's something that we try to build into the business and then to the business model, and we do that through sort of storytelling workshops and masterclasses about how you bring yourself into the space, so just I think also trying to, like I said earlier, is that there is this, it's difficult to balance the social impact with the maintaining of the like financial sustainability, because I know Sanile mentioned many different types of sustainability. So one of those things is financial sustainability, and really, really honing in on how you are going to be literate, financially literate. How mm-hmm. are you actually going to take that, once again, take it the distance by learning skills around managing your finances very, very well? What would be the most effective way of you bringing in money to your enterprise? Which is very difficult to do as a social entrepreneur, because you are holding these two things in tandem in your mind at all times. Mm. You're not just a money-making machine. You are also trying to create impact as well. And then because we do focus on social enterprises, we also want to help and enable entrepreneurs to think about this, element of care. And I think you're part of the business ecosystem, but you're also operating in a context where you are trying to serve your own community members or serve the planet.
Yeah.
And so building in that culture of care, and then that comes along with research, like you also mentioned. You need to understand what the needs of the space are.
Right.
So researching, always gaining knowledge, always keeping on top of trends, thinking about what would be innovative in the space. These are the kinds of things that we are thinking about in the programs and enabling entrepreneurs to think about as well.
Amazing. So collaboration and innovation equals sustainability.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome. I want to touch on a bit of a complex topic, which is tech.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to acknowledge what you also mentioned, Tasneem, that in order to have a business, you don't have to have something shiny and new. Mm. And I personally came to this realization in my final year of university, and we came up with this idea. I didn't think much of it. We ended competitions, pitching competitions for it, and I didn't think it would get far because I was like, it feels too basic, you know. I feel like I should have something shinier, but I was extremely surprised by how well received this idea was.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that despite that, you know, there is still a rapidly evolving tech environment that we are currently living in. Mm. And not so long ago, we were experiencing what's called the fourth industrial revolution, which is basically where now we're, you know, experiencing a lot of tech automation and robotics being introduced into our lives. And we've now moved into what's now called the fifth industrial revolution, where tech is being programmed to work alongside people. And there is, you know, there is a bit of tech is just more involved in our everyday lives. And how I'm wondering, from your perspective, how important do you think that a social entrepreneur leverages tech in their business, and what kind of benefits could it contribute, or if not benefits, what kind of disadvantages,
yeah,
if there are?
Great. So I think for me, the first of all, within the South Africa or African, you know, landscape of social entrepreneurship, we do need to acknowledge the existence of the digital divide.
Mm.
So in other words, there are certain geographies where there's massive progression of what technology means for those markets.
Right.
At the same time, where also there are communities where technology has literally no reach. In other words, there's no network, there's no connectivity, there's no way in which people have access to devices, and sometimes people haven't even seen an ATM, for that matter, right?
Mm.
So we do need to acknowledge that across Africa, there's major digital divides that still exist. And so when we look at the progression of the influence of technology for entrepreneurs or for social entrepreneurs in particular, we also need to be aware of the scaling and the pace at which technology disrupts the day-to-day livelihoods of people.
Right.
Because there's definitely a major deepening of inequality that happens within that. And obviously, for every inequality that we can see in our society, there's deep levels of questions of dignity. So when a person feels that they don't belong, or they can't use, or they don't know how to, a big part of who they are shrinks, because then now they feel like they're isolated from that level of mobility, or that level of maneuvering. And so it's important for us to acknowledge digital divide, but at the same time also to understand that we are living in a global environment that has a particular pace in which technology is evolving. And so we do have to work hard towards using technology to accelerate social delivery. In other words, how do we use drones to deliver medicine in our communities? How do we see more people in the internet and actually using e-commerce? How do we see more people using Uber Eats and actually ordering around their own spaces? So a good example of that, and how technology for me has become beautiful, is that every time I'm in Johannesburg, and maybe I go to work in, do some consulting work in Sandton, for example, I often Uber Eats from Alex.
Wow.
Yeah, because then it's always like cheaper food from Alex.
Right.
And I know that I'm supporting someone who's just making pap and maybe like a nice beef stew. Right. And it's from Alex, and it just gets Uber Eats. Like, it travels across the Sandton. And so for me, that's how technology in many ways has kind of done the leveling, the level ground, where that person in Alex actually as a market of someone sitting in a fancy office in Sandton, right? As opposed to me going to Chicken Licken or going to Kauai, I can just go to Uber Eats, which is using technology, and then accessing that entrepreneur in the township and actually providing capital to them. So, and I think also with commerce, there's also a very big question around the introduction of Amazon and Takealot into the ecosystem of e-commerce. And I think accountability needs to be questioned around how many products do they have that are coming from marginalized rural communities that otherwise wouldn't have access to distribute. So I think a big part of the questions we need to ask is around, you know, how are these big companies, global companies, actually including local products into their value chains? Because a big part of what they would do by doing that is really give the digital access for people to now start saying, oh, okay, if Amazon has a particular way of sourcing their products, I'm sure it's somewhere along the way there's technology requirements. People are very quick and eager to learn how they can adapt to those technological requirements. And so I think a big part of it is also really getting organizations like Amazon, Takealot, to work with Oribi, for example, to work with our business as well, to really strengthen the ecosystem of social impact and to get the right products to the right shelves. But again, coming to the fear of technology and the fear of robots and the fear of artificial intelligence, I don't think we should fear that at all. Rather, I think we should really play a precautionary kind of like idea towards that. So in other words, we must resist radical shifts in how, you know, because we still exist in a society of deep inequality.
Right.
So we cannot easily have robots now. If you go to the airport, they're the ones that check you in, because that could have been someone's job.
Yeah.
And that person has a family, and that family, there's a child that needs to grow, and that child has a future to play in this country. So we need to also understand the barriers that technology in its rapid advancement, what consequences it produces. But also to say that the only way to achieve greater leveling ground for technology in the global sphere is, to what point is our schooling system using technology?
That was my next question.
You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
We need to really get schools to be more involved in, you know, kids knowing that in the classroom there's a projector, and there's, because in universities that's what they get to experience. So the quicker our educational system gets away from the chalkboard,
right,
the more we're introducing technology in a much more sustainable and equalized manner.
Absolutely. And I mean, what is, because of this digital divide, what is the reasoning behind it? And are there, what's being done to, or what can be done to assist these communities that don't have access to tech, to help them, I guess, essentially catch up with with the rest of the world.
I think that the catching up will take a bit of time depending on which context you work with. Obviously, South Africa is not as bad as many other countries. If you look at where the DRC is, you know, quite probably more behind than we are. If you look at Uganda, they could be more behind than we are. But what's also interesting is that everyone plays Lotto. So wherever you are, people play Lotto. And also when you play Lotto, it's like this very this very intrusive business that has a way to find itself everywhere using technology. So it's also like the speed of how is technology fast? What areas of technology can penetrate or can infiltrate in communities? And I found Lotto to be a primary example of rapid distribution of technology in order for them to essentially run the system of gaming. And so I think we need to then question, at what point is technology also used to empower people in a more sustainable way, where either people are empowered to start businesses, to scale their businesses? How is technology used to make people use online payments? I know Yoko is doing its best to really, to get a reach. In other words, a township entrepreneur can have a Yoko machine. I mean, they're really doing quite well in that outreach. But what more can be done to even get a gogo who's got a vegetable garden and she's selling to actually use the payments online, or to maybe use a digital process and so on. So I think digitalizing is very intentional, but I think the scaling of it has to do a lot with just not necessarily chasing the profitability of what technology can do, but also chasing the potential of how technology can transform lives and make life easy. Even within the medical space, there's so much more technology can do. Even in the social grants space, I mean, I don't even go into the idea of scamming, because oh my God, people get scammed out there with technology because of the illiteracy of how to use it. So that's also a very unfortunate part. But I think there's a lot of intentionality that technology can drive. And it begins with outcomes. It begins with, if we introduce technology to this community or to this group of people, what is the desired outcome? Is it profit or is it actually transform their lives for better?
Wow. And have you seen any examples of social enterprises that are leveraging technology for good?
I think a very good example is someone that I thrift from. So most of my clothing is thrifted most of the time. And the person that I thrift from, recently introduced a Yoko machine. So I was like, oh, yay. I don't have to now bring cash to buy. So like, and often that's been going around a lot, where people are using the online payment system. But a good social enterprise that's obviously using good technology is an enterprise such as an organization I helped start become early founders of. It's called Go 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 Go. So it's basically like a grandmother's program where we teach grandmothers how to be technologically savvy. So in other words, we've worked with Cell C, and we've worked with, I think it was Vodacom, if I'm not mistaken, as well as Vumatel. And they donated tablets for grandmothers to actually learn how to Uber, how to WhatsApp call, and basically, in other words, their household would have a tablet and have internet. And what we found was that the grandmothers will call their grandchildren to come and apply for bursaries, to come apply for university, to come look for jobs in those tablets.
Wow.
They could WhatsApp each other if they're not feeling well, or and remedies could pass through that tablets. They started opening bank accounts. They could Uber each other. And I found that to be such an important social enterprise to start. But obviously the target market wasn't the young people, which I think there's so much overinvestment in young people. And we're forgetting that the people with a lot of authority are grandmothers. Because grandmothers in South Africa, for example, raise over 3 million children raised by grandmothers. So if you empower grandmothers, you are directly impacting those 3 million and so children who are going to benefit from the tech advancement of their grandmothers. And therefore, directly, they get a lot of access to technology, a lot of quick access to knowing how to use it. But also the grandmother will say, won't you search this for me? And so the child would learn how to search, and that automatically becomes research.
And another amazing enterprise that you mentioned earlier was the one that's based here in Cape Town, that, you know, alerts other shacks when there are fires that are about to start.
So there's an amazing business called Lumkani. Right. So Lumkani is an amazing, innovative, you know, enterprise that also leverages off technology to have significant impact in communities. But I think the biggest example is how in Cape Town, because it's a Cape Town founded business, right. By Francois, and it has grown with the backup of Hollard Insurance, which backs them up.
Wow.
And what they do is essentially give people in townships or informal settlements early alarm systems in case there's a fire. Mm. So if there's a fire, either in your house or next door, as soon as you press that alarm, their call center has immediate responses ready to quickly respond to the fire. Mm. And so they quickly can mobilize the right resources to basically mitigate the impact of the fire through that system. But what's also more innovative is that there's also an insurance product where it can give you a funeral benefit cover. So if someone died in a fire, you can have a funeral cover to have a funeral for that person.
Mm.
But it also has an element of a payout of cash that can help you rebuild or can help you recover from the particular losses that you may have had in the fire. So if you think it's Masiphumelele, Khayamnandi, there's often fires every other day and people's lives are just completely destroyed. So this is a solution that says to people, you know, you can alarm us, you can alarm, and as soon as you do that, there's a rapid response to it. But what's also interesting with that is that technology through that alarm system has actually not only helped the person who has bought the product immediately is of benefit to so many other people.
Wow.
Because the fire would have spread so much if there was no early warning system or any alarm.
True.
But because of this person having this product, a lot of other people in homes actually get safe and get protected from the spread of fire because of the quick response.
Wow.
So that's how technology has essentially reached, you know, the idea of township or informal settlements and in a way of social ecological resilience because
amazing.
Of the fires are caused by all kinds of weather patterns.
That's true. Wow, thank you so much for that. And this is my last question to you both. How can individuals and potential partners get involved in the initiatives that you are leading?
So for me, it's easy. Visit oribi.org.za. All the information about our programs is on that website. And then you can also visit our social media, so Instagram, oribi_South Africa. Where we're just showcasing a lot of the work that we're doing on there. And then we do have programs running every year. We work with high school girls in our GIB program. We work with food system entrepreneurs. Even those at a very early stage, if you just have an idea that's been validated in some way, look out on our website and our social media for our programs. We do run them every year. And it's we're not stopping. We just we're just gonna grow and grow our community, and very excited for what comes out of our programs.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Sandile?
See, I think same for us as well. I think just follow us on Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, Huruma Banvu. So it's Huruma Bantfu, Huruma Banvu. So that's where we share a lot of opportunities. We also have a thing where on Instagram, we really share other opportunities from the ecosystem. So if there's jobs, if there's talks, programs, opportunities, we just like to share because it's strengthening the ecosystem. But I also just like to end, because it's Mandela Day in 2 days, and I wrote this beautiful poem, and I'd just like to end this poem, we'll end the podcast today with this poem that I wrote.
Absolutely.
And hopefully everyone can receive it well and it can spark some sort of thoughts. The poem is titled, Mandela, Where Are You? The Mandela International Day, commemorated on the 18th of July annually, affectionately known as Mandela Day, calls on everyone to do what you can with what you have where you are. It is a day of intense corporate philanthropy, heightened citizenry, and deep empathy for the poor, marginalized, forgotten people in our communities. Gayton blows whistle. But Mandela, where are you? When the consistent corporate scandals continue to uncover themselves, when unethical leaders get rewarded with political promotions when the private public sector collude to steal from gogos and the disabled. Do what you can this Mandela Day, but how when families in Kayamnandi are still waiting for their cheques to dry up from the Cape storm, when Jocelyn Smith is still not found, Didi Lekganyane stabbed to death by her partner, yet budget cuts for gender-based violence interventions because of increased defense and military expenditure, another memorial service for our soldiers bombed in the DRC. How are we collectively working towards sustainable solutions when life SEDimeni perpetrators are flying business class to retreats in Bali, when the government of National Unity has still not agreed on what to do with township economic opportunities? No oil, no food, no electricity, no water, damaged pipeline, piles, measles of poo-poo. Mandela, where are you? Tell us. Eskom won't ditch coal. The Electoral Commission is to be untrusted. School unprepared for climate crisis. Battle looms over Durban social housing. And blocked drain leads city officials to decompose body. Mandela, where have you been? Food availability, accessibility, utilization, affordability, food security is a complex issue. John Steinhausen comes to our rescue. Outrage as 4 kids are shot and wounded. Oprah raped his granddaughter last night. Government to spy on social media users. VBS looter sipping on Vev at Taboo. Hazardous legacy of Krugersdorp abandoned mines. Load shedding returns after elections. Is Kakprat or Mandela, where are you? Flag burning is treason. Jacob Zuma may run for president again to come back and fix things while President Ramaphosa at home and not ill. Help us locate you, Mandela, as we go and feed the nation or attend another conference to speak about all the above on the 18th of June 2024.
Wow. Thank you so much for that powerful poem. Wow. Thank you guys both for making time for us today and your dedication to sharing your knowledge and, you know, just bringing more inspiration and motivation into the social entrepreneurship sphere. You are both doing very important and amazing work. So thank you guys. And that's it for today's episode of Real Talk with Arabi. A huge thank you to our guest Sandile and Tasneem for sharing their insights and experiences. We hope you found this conversation as inspiring and enlightening as we did. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, leave a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at @RAB_South Africa to stay updated on upcoming episodes and the latest news from RAB.